This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. In late 19th century London, a civil servant named Ellie Mallory finds herself longing for an archaeological excursion that would help her make her mark on a field dominated by men. As she's fired from her job for an act of political protest, she finds a clue that leads her to the jungle of South America, where she, with some help, uncovers a previously unknown civilization with a dark secret. That is the premise of the debut novel by Kensington, New Hampshire author Jacqueline Benson. It's called The Smoke Hunter, and Jacqueline Benson joins me now to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you.
This novel, set in late 19th century, in a world where patriarchy has pretty clear rules about what women can and cannot do, Ellie pushes against these limits. And this strikes me as something that a lot of women 118 years later would still relate to.
It is. I think it's a very relevant topic right now. I was just getting into a debate about what feminism is today in the office of my day job the other day. And that's a question that I think a lot of people have a hard time defining. But certainly for Ellie, and I think it's something that while we can relate to it, I think sometimes we forget how recently things were so different for women. Ellie is a suffragette in the novel. She could not vote. And I think that's something that a lot of women would be shocked to realize was the reality so recently, just, you know, a little over not even 100 years ago. And for her, she doesn't accept that. She's not willing to just sit with that and pretend that it's okay. She has a bit more of a modern mindset, which, of course, because I'm a 21st century writer, it's a lot more fun to write about than somebody who just thinks it's fine that women can't vote or get the sort of jobs that they're interested in.
And so she takes advantage of her friend's identity, her friend being a married woman, so that she's able to go overseas and pursue this ambition of hers, which is to make her mark on the archaeological world and find this civilization that she has evidence, reason to believe that is out there.
Yeah, it's not, the change of identity is a little bit more of a sort of accident of the circumstances of her escape. But traveling as a single woman in the 19th century wasn't that eyebrow raising. Thinking that you could actually do something consequential while you were traveling as a 19th century woman, that would raise a little bit of ire and potentially open her up to some social repercussions. You know, that's how a lot of this was enforced. And while I don't think Ellie minds that, those impacts would hit her family and other people that she cared about as well. The reputation that she has as a female, as a middle class woman, is something that isn't just about her. It's something that's about her whole circle, even if she was willing to just toss it out the window. So she heads out. She heads out into the jungle to try and do something a little extraordinary. And there were women who did that. She's not there are real life cases of female archaeologists and explorers. But what they had that Ellie didn't is independent income. Most of them.
They were wealthy, so they could
wealthy.
Do this.
Yes, that's what made a difference. If you were a woman who had some money, then you could go off and have these adventures, and society might not love you for it. But for Ellie, looking for this as a job, in a situation where she'd have to get a university position or find funding from a museum, they're not going to offer that. They're not going to offer that to a female in 1898. Mm-hmm. She actually has a cousin, I mention him in the book, that she's very close with, who is a guy, obviously, and he has taken the path that she would have taken. And he's off in Egypt excavating. And she is just as qualified, just as educated, just as interested. And the best she can do is working this dry job in the public records office that everybody tells her she should be lucky to have gotten, because most women in the civil service were typists.
Mm-hmm. But she graduated from the top of her class, so she can clearly do this and more if she were allowed.
Absolutely. Right. Yes.
There is a romantic subplot here. Mm. But what I like about this romantic subplot is that it doesn't follow the typical cliche of the romantic subplot where they get married in a conventional way at the end and all is settled. The guy she's with during the course of this adventure, Adam Bates, he says he's not the marrying type, and she sort of felt the same way about herself. So as they get closer, Forgive me for spoiling a little bit of it. Sorry.
Alerts.
alerts, readers. But they sort of work out an arrangement where she can still have her independence and she can still pursue this career that she wants to pursue.
Yeah, I think that's... She's somebody who's never really considered romance. She's never considered that because one of those weird facts of history, it was weird enough for a woman to get a job in the civil service. But if you did and you got engaged, you lost your job.
Mm-hmm.
So you either stayed unmarried and worked or you got married and you couldn't. So she basically would have had that in her mind the whole time, that if she chose to pursue a path of getting into a relationship, it would mean that what little career she can have is at an end. So for her, yeah, there's no way. This isn't an option for her. And most men of the period that she would have encountered would have had probably much more conventional ideas about what they expected from a wife, which also would have tied her into the home and limited her ability to pursue her interests as a scholar. But Adam is very different, and he's very much an iconoclast. He's somebody who's forged his own path in life and therefore I think has a respect for other people regardless of their gender who do the same thing. And that makes him a little more open-minded. Though, again, he's not looking for a conventional domestic relationship because he's in a position where he can't really offer a wife the things that he would expect a conventional 19th century woman to be looking for.
Mm-hmm.
He lives a pretty dangerous and unpredictable lifestyle. So,
in that sense, they're perfect for each other.
Well, we certainly hope so. That's half the fun.
I mean, we seem to know it long before they do.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she resists with all her might, even though they end up getting tangled up in interesting ways. Those I won't spoil.
Thank you.
So this is a relatively long book for a debut novel. And I wanted to ask you, because it's so thrilling and the suspense level is so high throughout, how did you manage to maintain that high level of suspense throughout 400 plus pages?
Well, this is, to answer that question, I have to get a little geeky. We've got to talk a little bit about writing process here. I'll tell you that when I wrote this book, I did it in what we call the fly by the seat of your pants method.
Also known as pantsers.
Pantsing, exactly. Yep. I sat down, I started chapter one and just worked my way through to the end. And what I found is the middle gets dull. In a lot of cases, I think this is a problem you hear a lot of people talking about, their saggy middles. They're not just talking about like post-pregnancy or having too many donuts, because it is cider donut season. But that happens very often in books when you're flying by the seat of your pants, because it becomes kind of hard sometimes to think of, well, I've resolved this issue, I've resolved that issue, I know what the end is, but I've got another couple of chapters to fill. So if you read the first draft of this book, you'd think, oh, gee, really? Jack, what were you thinking? But that's what the revision process is for. And when I looked at it in the revision process, I was able to see places where I didn't feel like it had the right tension. And stepping back from it and basically taking that first draft and treating it like an outline and taking the whole thing down into pieces. And then I was able to see, okay, there are threads that I've placed in the first part of this story that I can, with just subtle changes in the way that my characters are thinking or in the way that a scene concludes, I can make these pieces of the story more uncertain and make them more threatening and increase the stakes. I think in any story, especially when in a thriller novel, a lot of what builds tension is about the mysteries that you withhold, the stakes, the both personal and for your characters and for the world at large. That are resolved, and also the promises that you make to readers. So with a romance, the promises, you've got these two characters that the reader knows have some kind of tension between them, and they know that they're going to get together, unless this is like one of those more depressing literary novels where everything goes horribly wrong. part of the fun of that is fulfilling that promise, but doing it in a way where it doesn't quite play out the way that they expect. Where you're able to kind of tease and toy with your reader's expectations. So there's a lot of different ingredients that go into this recipe, and it's definitely one that I'm constantly tweaking. And I've learned from writing this book, this was my first novel, and so there was a lot of learning that went along with creating it, that I I believe that I'm better able to build tension if I don't do the pantser method, if instead I actually become one of those plotter people who outline the whole book ahead of time. And that gives me this bird's eye view where I'm able to better identify where the story might need more tension and where the potential for tension is. As far as I'm concerned, you can never have too much tension in a book. So it's always about trying to ratchet it up to another level.
I can hear all the people who are fans of this first book saying, no, no, don't mess with the formula. What you did last time, just do it again. But you're not going to. You're going to plan it out next time.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I will. But it won't change the reader's experience. It's just a matter of me figuring out how my own brain works. You know, that's not something that just happens with the snap of your fingers. It takes a lot of trial and error and mistakes and experimentation to find what works best for you as a writer. And I think that the best writers are the ones who are constantly continuing to challenge and test out their process, find something that just really helps them translate from idea to words on a page in the most powerful way that they can.
You mentioned in your biography here wanting to be Indiana Jones when you grew up. So safe to say you were a fan of the movies and that is to some extent an inspiration for this book, The Smoke Hunter.
Yeah, absolutely. No shame. No shame there. Yes, I grew up on Indiana Jones and I thought it sounded like the coolest job in the world. You know, if I could have applied for the job of being Indiana Jones, I would not have written the book. I'd be off fighting Nazis and working my way through like ancient buried cities. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your perspective, that's not what archaeology actually looks like. And I've learned that since I've gotten older and started studying a lot of archaeology. It's a lot more like sitting in the mud, digging up little pieces of pottery and then painstakingly fitting them all together. And it's fascinating. But I was not so much in love with the science as I was with the adventure. And I think that's what when I realized that, I realized that what I wanted to do was be a storyteller and tell these kinds of just really exciting stories with elements of history and mythology and mysticism and high stakes and dangerous enemies. And live that life vicariously in the comfort of my cozy office with my slippers on and my wood stove and my mug of tea.
And your bio also says that you spent 4 years living in a museum.
I did.
So I have to ask, what museum and why?
I lived at Hamilton House in South Berwick, Maine, which is a lovely property. If anyone, I'm sure some of your listeners have probably been up there. It's a historic New England property. It's an 18th century it was originally kind of a manor house and then converted into a summer home. And there's a caretaker's cottage, and I was a caretaker. So I lived in the caretaker's cottage, and my husband and I and our cats kept an eye on the property through the winter, living right on the banks of the Salmon Falls River in just this absolutely beautiful spot. But the cottage is a historic property, so it had historic windows and historic insulation. And after a while, we decided to pass the torch and stay warm.
Yeah, 4 years is a long time. I just recently learned that you also write plays.
I do.
Tell us about your experience writing plays. What do you write about?
I write suspense and sci-fi thrillers that I put on stage. I've had two full-length shows, one of them called Interference that I co-wrote with Heather Burbo, and we... that's a story about a group of paranormal investigators on a ghost hunt in a theater. So you are actually in the theater experiencing a haunting as it takes place. It's a lot of fun. We do a lot of tricks and a lot of special effects to really make it a cool, spooky experience. And then Crush Depth was my other full length, and that is about... it takes place in the control room of a Los Angeles-class submarine during the Cold War and has to do with... a rescue mission that goes awry and some very strange Twilight Zone-y sort of things that happen as a result.
Mm-hmm. Now, these two forms, novel writing, playwriting, do they inform each other? Does one help you write the other?
Oh, certainly. A lot of what the playwriting helps with is focusing on dialogue as a means of communicating character, because when you write a play, that's all you have. You've got to let your actors and your director know who these people are purely on the basis of how they speak and what they say. And so in writing a novel, I think a lot of times one of the weaknesses I see in a lot of popular fiction is where dialogue becomes just this sort of like box that the author uses to fill up plot points or move things along without really being authentic to who your characters are. And for me, I have to have them speak in a way that reflects their individual experiences and really shares that with the reader. So that'd be one area where the playwriting has definitely been a big help.
Well, Jacqueline, thank you very much for coming in and talking to me about The Smoke Hunter.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
That's Jacqueline Benson. She's the author of The Smoke Hunter, and you can find a list of the top 5 books on Jacqueline's bookshelf at nhpr.org. We're always looking for reading recommendations from listeners like you, so send them our way. Our email address is books@nhpr.org. You can also tweet us at nhprbookshelf. This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.